Nobody bothered to ask him, what are you doing here? Because he couldn't possibly have any lawful business there. There were a few black slaves working in chains out in the field, but no free Negroes. Then, somewhere around 775 B.C., disaster hit. Now, some of the early kingdoms finally realized that on the death of the king, sometimes the kingdom was up for grabs, because the crown prince hadn't yet demonstrated any particular ability. He hadn't gained the loyalty of the army, and any army officer who could get the backing of a substantial part of the troops might seize the throne. Therefore, several of them, including Babylon and Egypt, finally came to the idea that the king would appoint his oldest son co-regent with him as soon as the boy became old enough that he might be able to do something useful and to gain the respect of the officers who worked under him. So that for the last several years of his father's reign, the crown prince was sharing the authority of the kingdom with him, and when his father died, the son already had the power of the throne and the loyalty and respect of the officers under him. And they did very often in that way succeed in getting an orderly transition of power. But not always, because the co-regent crown prince sometimes just couldn't make the grade. And that's what happened in Egypt back around 775 B.C. Now, prior to that time, Egypt had conquered what they then called Nubia. It took in what today we call the Sudan, and perhaps a bit beyond that into Ethiopia. Negro population. Egypt had conquered Nubia. And not only did they take a lot of Negroes as slaves to work in Egypt, but here were a lot of big, husky Negroes, not brains enough to be afraid of anything, and they drafted them into the Egyptian army. Why should we go out and get killed when we can get these foreigners to be mercenary troops for us? You know, Rome finally reached the point where she had to do that, and the fall of Rome came pretty speedily after it. So, the Pharaoh of Egypt died, and the throne was up for grabs. And the Egyptian officer in charge of Nubia had a big army of these Negro troops. And he marched swiftly north and seized Egypt with his Negro army. Well, his dynasty, propped up by the sword of his Negro troops, his dynasty held the throne for about 75 years. And by the end of that time, Egypt was a mulatto nation. The greatness of Egypt in every respect ended at that time. Their art and architecture was of no consequence after that. Up to that time, they had been one of the great world empires. From then on, they were kicked around by any military adventurer who could raise anything more than a half-pint army with which to invade and conquer Egypt. So Jeremiah said, "You fools, you're relying on this mulatto nation to strengthen you when you are under attack by the greatest empire in the world, Babylon. It isn't going to work." And here was the man who had been twice back, presumably, to Babylon. And it's worthy of note, by the way, that in the final conquest and deportation of Jerusalem, it records Jeremiah 39 verse 11 to 40 verse 5 that Nebuchadnezzar had given special instructions to his generals to take good care of Jeremiah when they captured the city. So the princes said, "You're conspiring with our enemy." Jeremiah 26 records it. Now it came to pass, when Jeremiah had made an end of speaking all that Yahweh had commanded him to speak unto all the people, that the priests and the prophets and all the people seized him, saying, Thou shalt surely die. Why hast thou prophesied in the name of Yahweh, saying, This house, the temple, shall be like Shiloh, and this city shall be desolate without an inhabitant? And all the people were gathered against Jeremiah in the house of Yahweh. When the princes heard these things, they came up from the king's house unto the house of Yahweh, and sat down in the entry of the new gate of Yahweh's house. Then spake the priests and the prophets unto the princes and all the people, saying, This man is worthy to die, for he has prophesied against this city, as ye have heard with your own ears. So there was quite a debate over it. Jeremiah defended himself. Then spake Jeremiah unto all the princes and to all the people, saying, Yahweh sent me to prophesy against this house and against this city all the words that ye have heard. Therefore now amend your ways and your doings, and obey the voice of Yahweh your God, and Yahweh will repent him of the calamity that he has pronounced upon you. But know ye for certain, that if ye put me to death, ye shall surely bring innocent blood upon yourselves and upon this city. For of a truth, Yahweh hath sent me unto you to speak all these words in your ears. So they held a debate. Some of them cited the case of the prophet Micah, who had similarly prophesied disaster and had not been murdered because he was speaking in the name of God. Others cited a prophet named Uriah, who had been put to death by orders of the king on such an account. But finally, he was acquitted. Then said the princes unto all the people, unto the priests and to the prophets, This man is not worthy to die, for he has spoken to us in the name of Yahweh our God. One reason for his high standing, when it really came down to the pinch there, was that he may have been related to the king. The last king of Judah, Zedekiah, was the son of Hamutal, the daughter of Jeremiah of Libna. Now, if Jeremiah of Libna is the same person as Jeremiah of Anathoth, and those are both Levite cities and fairly close together, why then, he was the grandfather of Zedekiah. Now, we don't know to a certainty, but it's a possibility there. Well, we all know, of course, of Zedekiah's fate, because he wouldn't listen to Jeremiah. Now, the churches have made us acquainted with Jeremiah's prophecies of doom. He was telling the people how he worried over what was happening. He said, I'm weeping for what I know is going to come to you. And they call him the weeping prophet and so on. We know also that he prophesied the future glory of Israel. Not Judah, Israel. Now remember, the people of the northern kingdom of Israel had gone into the Babylonian captivity and disappeared from the Bible record by 715 B.C. at the latest. And here, a little over a century later, Jeremiah was prophesying the magnificent future of Israel. But there's one thing that I don't believe we have had called to our attention very often, and that is that Jeremiah also was prophesying the coming of Christianity. It's interesting, you find this in the 30th chapter of Jeremiah. Therefore, fear thou not, O my servant Jacob, saith Yahweh, neither be dismayed, O Israel, for lo, I will save thee from afar. Remember now, this was practically a century and a quarter after they had disappeared from any historical record in the Bible. For I will save thee from afar, and thy seed from the land of thy captivity. For I am with thee, saith Yahweh, to save thee. A little too much competition outside, I'll wait. I make a full end of all nations whither I have scattered thee, yet I will not make a full end of thee, but I will correct thee in measure, and not leave thee altogether unpunished. Thus saith Yahweh, Behold, I will bring back the captivity of Jacob's tents, and have mercy on his dwelling places. And their nobles shall be of themselves, and their governors shall proceed from the midst of them. Self-government. And ye shall be my people, and I will be your God. Thus saith Yahweh, the people who were left from the sword found grace in the wilderness. Now remember, the grace of God is Paul's favorite theme. That's what he's always talking about. You have been trying to get the approval of God by earning it, by living up to the law. And you haven't succeeded, and you couldn't succeed. The favor of God comes by his grace as a gift to us. The people who are left of the sword found grace in the wilderness. Now the people of Israel, known as Scythians from the time they were settled around the southern end of the Caspian Sea, when they started their march on up into Europe, they were in the wilderness. Because as soon as they got far up the Danube Valley, they were getting into the great forested countries of Germany, Austria, the upper Balkan countries, up along the Baltic Sea. This was wilderness. The people of Judah in captivity in Babylon would have had hundreds of miles to travel to find a wilderness anywhere. The people which were left of the sword found grace in the wilderness, even Israel, when I went to cause him to rest. I am a father to Israel, and Ephraim is my firstborn. And you can't make that apply to Judah. Hear the word of Yahweh, all ye nations, and declare it in the isles far off, the British Isles to which they came, and say, He that scattered Israel will gather him and keep him as a shepherd doth his flock, for Yahweh hath redeemed Jacob and ransomed him from the hand of him that was stronger than he. Behold, the days come, saith Yahweh, that I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day that I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, which my covenant they broke, although I was a husband unto them, saith Yahweh. But this shall be the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, saith Yahweh. I will put my law in their inward parts and write it in their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. In other words, instead of compulsory obedience to law as a matter of form and lip service, it would be the voluntary obedience to the will of God coming from the heart. Now this whole last passage that I've read to you there is quoted word for word in the book of Hebrews in the New Testament. Hebrews 8, verses 6 to 13, they're quoting Jeremiah word to word on that as proof that this was what God had prophesied the coming Christianity would be. So Jeremiah was not only the prophet of doom, Jeremiah was not only the one who kept the throne of David in existence, transferring it to Ireland, where the Milesians were in charge. But Jeremiah was also one of the first to prophesy of Christianity. Now Isaiah, who prophesied somewhat earlier than he, was the first who gave any detailed explanation of the coming of the Savior and what he would do and so on. But what the results were going to be was told by Jeremiah. It's an interesting book to read. The other prophets give you very little picture of themselves. They tell you, thus saith Yahweh, and they make their message clear enough. But as the man himself, you don't get much understanding. But Jeremiah gives you a picture of the man himself. It's very interesting. I spoke on that once before quite a while ago, and it's too long to go over today, but you'll find it worth reading for that. The way he held up as well as he could under the tremendous troubles poured on him. They had some great men in those days, even if, as always, they hated them for their greatness. Jeremiah was one of the extremely few prophets who was not murdered for his pains. We know that he died peaceably in his old age in Ireland after taking Zedekiah's daughter, the Princess Teotepi, to Ireland and seeing her safely married to the Irish king. So you have the Milesian dynasty on the throne in Ireland. Before they left Egypt in the Exodus, one part of the tribe of Judah had already made a considerable exodus of its own. You remember that Judah left one half-breed son, Shelah, whose descendants were a source of trouble forever thereafter, but he left twin sons, illegitimately born, but purebred, Phares and Zerah. Well, twins are not born simultaneously, and Phares was the firstborn of the two, so that carried with it the right to the throne. Now, in those days, for an ambitious man to become president of Standard Oil Company was a little too difficult. If you had any real administrative ability, your only chance to use it was on the throne. So, here were people of great ability in this Zerah half of Judah, and the door closed to advancement to them. So it's a record that a considerable number of them left Egypt well before the Exodus. They went up the eastern coast of the Mediterranean. Some of them settled in Greece. Some settled on the mainland of Asia Minor, where they founded the city of Troy, and they founded the city of Miletus. And Miletus became a very important city. They had their own gold coinage, and stamped, by the way, with the lion of the tribe of Judah. Before Tyre and Sidon became the great popular merchant cities and established colonies, Milesia established colonies in a number of places around the Mediterranean, and especially they built a strong and powerful colony in Spain. Milesian troops were hired by the Egyptians as mercenary soldiers for border guards. From their settlement in Spain, the Milesians invaded Ireland and conquered it and became a ruling class there. As a matter of fact, the Milesians were the ruling class until they were conquered by the English kings, sometime in the 1200s, as I remember it. And those Irish, whose names begin with Mac or with O, can trace their lineage to these Milesians. So there you had, established in Ireland, a throne occupied by a descendant of the Zerah half of Judah. Now the kings in Jerusalem were from the Phares, part of the tribe. So when Zedekiah's daughter was married to Eochaid, the Heraman in Ireland, you had the two king lines of Judah united in one on the throne. From there, they settled Scotland. In fact, for many centuries, Ireland was known as Scotia Major, and Scotland was Scotia Minor. Later, the Irish dropped the Scot name, and the people in the northern half of the English island, adopted it and called it Scotland. Now that is why when Fergus, the Scottish king, was crowned, there was no objection to taking this stone on which the kings were crowned from Ireland to Scotland. These were the same people. This was part of the same royal family. And so it was taken there. And you remember from there, the British, the English, capturing Scotland, captured the scone, the stone of Scone, and took it to Westminster Abbey. But you remember, it was not too long after that, that a Scottish dynasty succeeded to the throne of England. So you've had the king line of David ruling always over some part of the Israel people. Thank you. Today I want to talk about the Stone of Destiny. In the coronation chair in Westminster Abbey in London is an oblong block of sandstone upon which all of England's kings have been crowned for several centuries. And before that, the kings of Scotland. And before them, the kings of Ireland. This is another bit of evidence of the identity of the Anglo-Saxon people as the Israel of the Bible, and that the house of David still rules over them. The history of this stone begins in the 28th chapter of Genesis, where we read that Jacob camped overnight in the field, and for his pillow used a stone with his folded cloak over it. During the night, God appeared to him in a vision and promised to give him the land of Canaan. When Jacob awoke, he said, "This is the house of God," and named the place Bethel, meaning house of God. Then he took the stone he had used as his pillow and set it up as a monument, and dedicated it with an offering of oil. He promised that if God would help him, "Then shall Yahweh be my God, and this stone which I have set for a monument shall be God's house." In Genesis 35, God instructs him to go back to Bethel and set up an altar to God, which Jacob did. It was at this time that God changed Jacob's name to Israel, and Israel again set up and dedicated as a monument of witness the stone pillar which he had dedicated as God's house. Its sacred character was now firmly established. We next find mention of it in Genesis 49, when the aged Israel, before he dies, tells his 12 sons what will befall their respective descendants in the last days. Speaking of Joseph, he says, "From thence is the shepherd of the stone of Israel. We should, therefore, expect to find the stone in the custody of the sons of Joseph in the last days." The English are the tribe of Ephraim, descended from one of Joseph's sons. Its sacred character having been established, the stone would not be thereafter abandoned. We next hear of it when the children of Israel, in their exodus from Egypt, were facing death by thirst in the desert. God instructed Moses, "I will stand before thee there upon the rock in Horeb, and thou shalt smite the rock, and there shall come water out of it, that the people may drink." And thus they were saved from death. This miracle was repeated later, but this time Moses was instructed merely to speak to the rock, not strike it. Because Moses disobeyed God and hit the rock in a grandstand play before the people, he was not allowed to enter the promised land. We must not think that this rock was merely the native rock cliffs of these desert places, for in 1 Corinthians 10, verses 1 to 4, Paul says, "All our fathers were under the cloud, and all passed through the sea, and did all drink the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ." That is, they were given water to drink from a rock which was carried along with them. And as Israel had said, "This stone which I have set up for a monument shall be God's house." So Christ hallowed it with his presence. After Joshua had conquered the promised land and divided it among the 12 tribes, he reminded them they must ever be loyal to God, and he set up a stone as a monument of witness to this warning. The Hebrew says he took the stone of greatness, and what would that be, or what more fitting witness could there be, but the stone which was God's house? Before God ever allowed Israel to have a king, the rebel Abimelech had himself crowned king beside this pillar of monument, as we read in Judges 9, verse 6. Later, when the lawful monarchy was established in the house of David, we find it was the custom that the king be crowned standing by the pillar or monument. For we read in 2 Kings 11, verses 12 to 14, "And he brought forth the king's sons, and put the crown upon him, and gave him the testimony. And they made him king, and anointed him, and they clapped their hands, and said, God save the king.
And when Athaliah heard the noise of the guard and of the people, she came to the people, into the temple of Yahweh. And when she looked, behold, the king stood by a pillar, as the manner was, and the princes and the trumpeters by the king, and all the people of the land rejoiced. The stone had become a sacred relic, a witness of the mutual promises of God and of the children of Israel. It would be found close to the temple and close to the throne. Upon the fall of Jerusalem to the Babylonians under Nebuchadnezzar, 2 Maccabees 2, verses 4 to 8 says that ancient records stated that Jeremiah had taken the Ark of the Covenant and the tabernacle and had hidden them in the cave on Mount Nebo. While 1 Samuel chapters 4 and 5 record the capture of the Ark by the Philistines and its return, there is no mention of it being taken by the Babylonians, so the ancient record of the Ark being hidden must be correct. Along with the Ark, we may be sure that Jeremiah would also safely hide the sacred witness stone, God's house, which had twice been used to give water to the people to save them from death, and which was now used in the coronation of the kings. When I spoke to you on what Jeremiah planted, I told you how Jeremiah and the daughters of the last king of Judah, Zedekiah, were taken to Egypt with the refugees. But in order to fulfill God's prophecy that Jeremiah was also to build and to plant, Jeremiah had to leave Egypt and to take the princess to where another Israelite kingdom was then in existence, in Ireland. We know that with Jeremiah went Baruch, his scribe, and the king's daughter, and with the princess he would also certainly take the hidden stone upon which the kings were crowned. The ancient Irish chronicles record the coming of the great prophet with his scribe, Brug, obviously Baruch, and the daughter of the king, about 583 B.C., which would be the correct date, and that with them they brought the wonderful stone, or stone of destiny. A woman of my acquaintance belongs to a family whose genealogy shows that one of their ancestors came to Ireland with Jeremiah, and that this ancestor's duty was that of custodian of the stone. Teatethi, the king's daughter, married Eochaid, the Heremon, or chief king of Ireland. The stone, called Leah Fael, or Stone of Destiny, was kept at the capital city of Tara for some 3 centuries, and all the kings, descendants of Eochaid and Teatethi, were crowned on it. Then, about 350 B.C., it was sent to Scotland for the coronation of Fergus, king of Scots, who was a descendant of the Milesian kings of Ireland. It remained in Scotland, and all Scottish kings were crowned on it until 1297 A.D., when King Edward I of England invaded Scotland and captured the stone, which he took to England, where it was placed in Westminster Abbey, its home ever since that date. It was built into the coronation chair, which is the oldest piece of furniture in England, still serving its original purpose, and all English kings have been crowned on it ever since. Its origin was well known during the entire time it has been in the British Isles, and from practically the first it was called Jacob's Stone. William of Rislanger, writing in the 13th century, records the coronation of John de Baliol as King of Scotland in the year 1292 upon the stone on which Jacob placed his head. While the 10-tribe nation of Israel had to abide many days without a king, as God prophesied in Hosea 3, verse 4, yet there must always be a royal family of David's line on the throne over some Israelite people. For God promised through Jeremiah 33, verse 17, that David shall never lack a man to sit upon the throne of the house of Israel. We know that Eochaid the Heremon was in the Milesian line of kings of Ireland, and that the Milesians in Ireland were the descendants of Zara, a son of Judah, and that Teatethi was a descendant of David, who was also of the royal tribe of Judah, through Judah's other son, Phares. So the two royal lines of Judah were united with the marriage of Eochaid and Teatethi, and a descendant of David was always on the throne over Israelite people, as God had promised. The Ark of the Covenant belonged in the temple, and the temple was not to be a continuous institution like the throne of David. So it is not surprising that the Ark has disappeared from history and probably will not be revealed again until Jesus Christ returns to reign upon the throne of David, as is prophesied in Isaiah 9, verse 7. But the throne was to be a continuous throne, as we saw in Jeremiah 33, verse 17. Therefore, it is only logical that the coronation stone, which the Hebrews had called the stone of majesty and the pillar of witness, should be found where the throne of David had its continued existence. After all, it was the pillar of witness, for it had been made witness both to Israel's promise to be Yahweh's people and Yahweh's promise to be their God. It should be there as a witness that Yahweh always makes good his promises and that David shall never lack a man to sit upon the throne of the house of Israel.